Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Emily Taylor, and I'm hosting today's program, which is being recorded at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Colby Vanderay, a senior at Aspen High School. She will be interviewing Gil Raphael, the Taylor W. Lawrence Professor of Theoretical Physics at Caltech and the chair of the faculty board there. He researches quantum dynamics and computing.
Hi, thank you so much for agreeing to be interviewed. I guess to start for the listeners, you're a professor at Caltech. Could you give a little bit of your educational background, where you attended undergrad, grad school, something like that?
Absolutely. So I grew up in Israel and I went to Tel Aviv University for my undergrad. I did a dual degree in physics and math, but fortunately my math grades were always about 5% lower than my physics ones. And then I applied for grad school in the United States and was accepted at Harvard and went there for grad school and graduated in 2003 and moved to the West Coast, where I was a postdoc in the University of California, Santa Barbara for 2 years, and then started a professorship at Caltech.
Excellent. Were there any specific offerings about Harvard or UC Santa Barbara that brought you to those locations in particular?
When I was applying for grad school, I had no idea what to expect, and these were the early days of the internet where pages were there, but they took like 2 minutes to load. So it was an adventure. And when I was admitted in a couple of places, I came to the United States. It was my first trip alone. I was very nervous. And I went around campuses and I couldn't really decide. And then I consulted some friends and family and thought about the environment where I visited, and settled on Harvard. I mean, it was a good combination of academics, like top-notch students, top-notch professors, and a city environment, which was bustling with other students in all sorts of fields. So it was a great environment to be a grad student in, and it was a great environment to be away from home in.
Brilliant. And I know you're obviously leading your own research now, but during your time at Harvard, were you participating in any research with professors, or and what did that entail?
Yeah, so as a graduate student, you have to engage deeply in research. That's your job. Produce a big body of study. There's always a bit of nervousness whether you would be able to come up with your own research and fulfill the requirements of a PhD, but everything works out in the end. So I started off chatting to a couple of professors, and circumstances were such that my advisor, Daniel Fisher, was staying at Harvard in the summer and offered some projects to me that sounded interesting. So I stuck around and started working with him on random quantum spin chains. And I stayed on for another 4 years, and we did a couple of, several problems together in different areas, and I even had the opportunity to come up with some of my own physics in the process.
So I guess my next question will be, what's the research process for like topics such as random quantum spin chains? Because I know I'm personally am unfamiliar, and I'm guessing the listeners are too. What would that look like on either a theoretical basis or an experimental basis?
So one of the focus of the field that I'm in, quantum matter, is magnetism. And we all know why. We all have fridge magnets. We play with magnetic toys. When I was a kid, there was magnetic recording devices, right, like videotapes and stuff like that. They're gone now, but still the physics is still there. So magnetism is up there as one of the challenging topics. And one question that my advisor at the time was very engaged with is, what happens when the magnetic material is very disordered? So, a lot of people like thinking about pure materials, perfect crystals. That wasn't our thing. We wanted the dirtiest of dirty. And there's a question of, how do you solve problems where you cannot rely on symmetries to simplify the problem, and you cannot rely on strong approximations that only apply for uniform systems? And I landed in the group provided a solution for a big chunk of this problem for one-dimensional magnets. So the problem is very simple. Just imagine having little magnetons, so electronic spins, sitting in a row. And they can interact with each other, with their neighbors. But maybe the row is not very organized. Maybe the distances between nearby electrons vary from electron to electron. and you want to figure out whether those electrons are going to arrange themselves in an anti-ferromagnetic pattern, so up, down, up, down, up, down, have any pattern, or be completely disordered. You know, we didn't know. And Daniel Fisher came up with a method called renormalization, real space renormalization group method. He adapted that method to this system and solved that problem completely. And when I came in, he suggested this, among other problems, as startup problems for me. And, you know, I was a nervous kid coming to grad school, not knowing if I'll manage it. So I looked at the list of problems suggested. And this one looked the easiest to me.
That's the easiest
one. That looked the easiest to me. So I said, oh, why did I do that? And it wasn't so easy. But as I learned the topic and learned how to engage with the solution that Daniel provided and extract more information out of it, I also came up with my own idea for magnetic transitions that can happen in systems like that.
Wow, that's great. And so, I mean, you already kind of touched on this a little bit and how that experience influenced your current research, but can you speak a little bit about what you're working on currently?
Sure. So I have to say, whenever I'm asked to talk about my current research, I start being confused because I'm thinking about several different problems at the same time. I think the most exciting thing to me right now is thinking up of ways of controlling the behavior of many electrons in materials using external stimuli. So say you have a material that's kind of boring, like say silicon, like some semiconductor that doesn't have so many features. We know the physics of it. But maybe if we shine some light on it or shake it in a particular way, it will become an interesting material. For instance, a topological insulator. You shake it a little bit and suddenly, instead of being a boring insulator, electrons form a metallic layer on the surface that has particular magnetic properties, can make exotic superconducting phases, and you know, that's one way of thinking about it. Can you think up of ways of steering up electrons to do things that are more marvelous than what they would do when you leave them alone?
Interesting. And so I guess do you have any like visions or hopes? Like, this is a very hard question, I'm sure. But visions or hopes for how your current research will influence the field of quantum computing moving forward?
Yeah, great question. So as I age, I like doing things that are a little more applied, closer to experiment. And one of the things that I think have a lot of potential right now is using these ideas of controlling the dynamics of electrons to produce new quantum devices. And such devices could take the form of qubits, or they can take the form of amplifiers, but on atomic scale. Or maybe there are other devices that we want to invent that can rely on quantum properties on the atomic level that would be useful. So I'm excited about the possibility that experiments now give to construct very tailored materials. And these materials can give rise to new types of electronic behavior that may translate into devices that would be useful either as quantum information processing hardware or the hardware that is used to, you know, bring the quantum information up to our level, you know, room temperature, you know, human size, regular computers. So there's a lot of room there, and I think there's a lot of room to think about new concepts of what a material could be like. So for instance, we have computers, right? Somewhere in the computer, there's a CPU. That's a chunk of semiconductor that was especially tailored to do certain actions, right? Mm-hmm. To process information. It consists of gazillion transistors, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we can do the same things, but on the atomic level, not on the, you know, million of atoms level. And then we could truly make quantum machines that may do new things.
Wow. That's great. And so, I mean, you kind of alluded to this already, but how do you approach the search for applications of more theoretical physics? Because mm-hmm. obviously, like, a lot of theoretical physics works with these ideal systems. So what's that process like for searching?
Oh, that's a great question. So my background is disordered quantum system. So I rarely dealt with the ideal system. I always thought about how a system is corrupted by nature. As I think about theoretical concepts, I try not to dig too deep into the theory, although some of my colleagues probably would say that I should. And I try to keep an eye out for things that are tangentially related, but are around us. You know, physics has this tendency of being the same along different scales. So you might see something around you that actually corresponds to some phenomena on the microscopic level, but they share some physical principle. And if you know your way around general physics and what experiments show in your field, but also in nearby fields, it's very easy to come up with ways in which a particular theoretical concept relates to experiments that you heard of, either from friends or in seminars or on the radio. So if you keep a broad perspective on physics, you see the patterns within physics, and you can see how something that may look like a very a very specific theoretical development, how that development may fit in the bigger picture, and what it could serve towards technological progress.
Very cool. And would you say that your time at the Aspen Center for Physics has helped? I know there's like a lot of conversations and just searching for that interconnectedness between the fields and applications.
Yeah, Aspen Center for Physics is a really unique place. So that's where you come to fill up. You know, that's where you fuel up on ideas, and you connect with colleagues who you would not normally run into in the course of your day-to-day. And it produces an exchange of ideas that's very intense. And I will have been here for 3 days when I leave tomorrow, but it'll take me a few weeks to process all the new ideas that I've encountered here. And it's always conversations that I have at the Aspen Center of Physics that reorient my thinking and my research.
That's brilliant. Obviously, you're a professor at Caltech. So my next question is, has teaching influenced your research at all, or has your research influenced how you have approached teaching?
Oh, yes. Yeah, as you can hear, I don't like compartmentalizing my physics. So I tend to think about my teaching in the context of my research and vice versa. So you can't always do this. You know, some courses are just courses, but I'd like to bring forward the things that excite me about the physics in the class material, and particularly the physics that I see affected my research the most. So I emphasize the things that I see that for me were important over the years. But apart from that, I have a side interest in explaining to our students how physics fits together as a whole, and how it can be used to model basically anything that you see around you. It can be used for my research, but it can also be used to explain how snow gathers and melts on our yards. And so one course that I teach at Caltech is geared towards modeling natural phenomena and technological developments. And in that course, every week we get together and we come up with a problem that's associated with some technological marvel or some natural phenomenon, and within an hour and a half come up with a model that gets the basics right.
Wow.
So it's like the physics know-it-all kind of class.
Can you give an example of a recent project that you've done in that class?
Or? Yeah, certainly. So the projects run the gamut from weather phenomena to physics of espionage, is one of my favorites, to green energy production and energy production in general. And so an example on atmospheric phenomena could be inversion layer physics, where smoke gets stuck on lower altitudes because of temperature rising. And the interesting phenomenon that happens when that happens is that sound gets reflected from the inversion layer. So if you live next to a freeway, you usually won't hear it. But when there's an inversion layer, you may get a reflection of the sound, and you will hear it very well.
Interesting.
And likewise, on the side of physics of espionage, that's a place where physics was obviously applied a lot. And one interesting piece of physics that's debated over the last few decades is, how do you communicate with submarines? You can't see submarines, right? That's why we use them. You can't broadcast to them because they're underwater. Radio waves don't get to them unless they're very low frequency. And that's fascinating physics. And because of this, you know, the United States built a set of antennas that are 20, 30 kilometers long in Wisconsin. India, China, Russia also have this kind of antennas, whose only purpose is to broadcast very few words every day to submarines hidden somewhere. And the physics of that is really fascinating to me. It combines so much in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know in my physics class, we were studying wave phenomena rather recently, and it's interesting to hear the application of that, even on such a macroscopic scale. Now, you mentioned that when I asked you about your current research, you said that there's a couple problems that you're working on. Is there another one that's exciting you that you'd like to share?
Let me think. So one thing that I'm doing is trying to come up with suggestion for hardware that gives you a very good qubit, and that's based on a theory by my colleagues John Preskill and Alexei Kitaev and Daniel Gottesman, so GKP qubit. And me and a friend came up with an idea of how to realize such a qubit simply in a superconducting device that's not that different than what people are using now for superconducting qubits. So I'm pursuing some of the implications of that construction, of that proposal. And on the other hand, I'm trying to figure out some phenomena that's really mysterious that was discovered in a material called, let me get this right, tantalum disulfate. What it shows is a weird memory effect. It's a material, just bulk material. You cool it down, it becomes superconducting. You apply a magnetic field to it when it's not superconducting. Nothing seems to happen. You remove the magnetic field, nothing seems to happen. It doesn't seem to be magnetic. It doesn't seem to show anything. But then as you lower the temperature and make it superconducting, the superconductor is speckled with vortices. What are these vortices? Magnetic field that penetrates the superconductivity. And that magnetic field seems to be a recording of the magnetic field that was applied earlier at higher temperature. But it's not clear how this memory is there. It's not clear what magnetic properties the system has that produces this memory. And it's like a detective story, right? You want to understand how the electrons behave such that on the one hand they hide their magnetism, on the other hand they remember somewhere in an encrypted way the magnetic field that you applied to them in the past and exhibit it when they start being superconducting.
So what does your research process look like for looking at these magnetic properties and the magnetism of this conductor?
So I talk to people. I talk to the people who did the experiment. I talk to friends. We come up with some rough settings. We come up with the rough parameters, you know, the playing field that we're in. And then we start letting our imagination go, like what kind of interactions can be produced, what kind of terms in the basic equation that describes the material could give rise to such a phenomenon. We read up a little bit on the material, try to understand what's special about it, and lean back on our experience. Try to come up with crazy ideas and then eliminate them, and sometimes come up with crazy ideas and try not to eliminate them. And in the end, you get a story, and that story may or may not apply to the material at hand, but it might reveal a new physical principle that can be seen in a different material, possibly.
When you're looking at all of these crazy ideas that it's kind of like a brainstorm coming up with, how do you determine which ones are worth pursuing?
Intuition. Sometimes it's childish stubbornness. You talk to a friend and they tell you that it's never going to work and you want to prove that it will just because. Or you talk to a colleague that you don't like too much and they tell you that it's wrong and you want to prove them wrong even more so. So it's a combination of intuition, stubbornness, and, I think one skill that physicists have is the ability to do rough calculations quickly, so kind of quick and dirty, to see whether something may or may not work. And you try to apply that. So you try to do a few quick and dirty calculations to see how bad things are for your idea and try to think whether you can overcome them or not. You know, there's no, speaking for myself, I don't have a clear vision of how a problem ends. But I do have a clear vision of how my thought begins. And then you start wondering from there and try to go where your curiosity leads you. And because of experience, your curiosity usually leads you somewhere good. It may not be exactly what you wanted to solve in the beginning, but you may solve something else that might even be more interesting.
Do you have an example of when this has happened for you, where like you may have been hunting for one answer and just found something entirely different?
Let me think about it for a second. One example, one of my favorite topics in the recent decade was this concept of energy pumping that Ivo Martin and I started discussing, I think, probably here. And we were thinking about what you can do when you apply multiple frequencies, multiple light beams to an electronic system. Is it useful? Is it not? We thought, well, it's probably a very difficult theoretical problem. You know, you have to think about the dynamics of driven electrons under complicated pulses, but maybe we can make magnets move in a certain way. And we started thinking about it, and then we realized, wait a second, no, there's something very special there. If you write the equation of motion for electrons under multiple beams, you could actually think about it as if those electrons are in a crystal and are just being pulled by some force. And then we thought, aha, but you have some interesting crystals out there that have properties that make them seem as if they're in a magnetic field. So maybe if we simulate the beams of light applied to these magnetic electrons to give the electrons the impression as if they're being pulled in these exotic materials, then something nice would happen. Then we realize that something, that nice thing is energy pumping. You know, if you apply two beams of light to a magnet in a particular way, to a quantum magnet in a particular way, then the quantum magnet will become a machine that passes energy selectively from one beam to the other.
Interesting.
That was a very fun discovery.
Great. So in your research process and in your search for new ideas of what to study and what to pursue, how often and how does it look to bring in graduate students or postdoc students for that work?
So there are two rough categories. So if I come up with an idea, I don't have the power to develop it on my own, so I need help. And I think who in my group would be most capable of addressing it, or who is in a search for a problem. And we chat together, and I try to interest them in the problem. Sometimes they tell me that the idea is not good. I should go back to the drawing board. Students and postdocs can do that to us. It's okay. And sometimes they get inspired, and they really run with ideas and get them done, or find different ideas nearby that are as exciting or more exciting and pursue them. When a graduate student starts, as I was describing before, how I started, there's a bit of a process as to how to start research. And depending on the student, they may come in with very strong interests in a particular topic, or they want to explore a little bit before they concentrate on something. So when that happens, we would think about what are our mutual interests and start reading around those interests, like particular topics in condensed matter or in quantum physics. And hopefully both of us will do the reading, but more likely the student will do the reading and tell me about it. And then we'll try to zoom in on a problem that interests us both and start tackling it. And it's not that hard to find problems in quantum physics. Once you know enough, you see where there are cracks in the wall, or you see where there are little places that offer opportunity to innovate and get some new ideas and come up with some new concepts or new paradigms. So that's where it's exciting. So the hard thing is to bring students to that level where they can recognize those opportunities for themselves. And when they do, that's when they become mature researchers.
Very cool. And you mentioned like all of the cracks in the walls, with it, especially within the area of quantum. There seems to be so much discovery coming out all the time right now. And so how do you decide where to go, which crack to follow? And, or like, I mean, I'm sure it's a little bit based on inspiration and just what strikes you, but what does that look like for you?
So there's a lot of intuition in it, going into it. But there's a lot of childlike curiosity. I mean, we are privileged to have the resources to do groundbreaking research on a daily basis. I think anywhere we look, there will be something interesting that could be pursued. What do I pursue? Do I eliminate ideas? Sometimes I do. Sometimes I feel that ideas are just too hard to pursue and the benefit would be too little. Sometimes I pursue ideas because I just find the question interesting, but I don't know what the benefit would be. But I think underlying it is not a cost-benefit analysis, but just childlike curiosity that we try to maintain. And I think because we're so trained in this field, because we got so many resources directed towards our training, our curiosity is good at identifying these opportunities. So that's where it comes out. That's where the payoff is. You know, we can pursue our curiosity and we have a good chance of it impacting science on a global level.
Great. And I guess to wrap things up, I know I personally am very interested in going into some form of physics as I go into college. Do you have any pieces of advice for anyone looking to pursue quantum mechanics or anything of that ilk?
I think it's a wonderful career. It's a wonderful thing to pursue. I think you should pursue it as long as you're excited about physics. And remember that physics is there to explain what's around you. And always connect what you study, what you learn in the classroom, with what you see around you. It all comes together this way. And if it comes together, if the physics comes together to inform your way of looking at the world, that's when it's the most exciting.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much. This has been Radio Physics. We've been speaking with Gil Raphael from Caltech and our high school intern, Colby Vanderay. We hope you enjoyed this Radio Physics. For more information about our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org.